I was ordained in 1987, and boy, have things changed. I have, for the last 10 years, done interim ministry, 7 total. The rest of my time, 25-year career, has been spent in short-term ministries, district arranged, or just congregations that wanted to work on governance or something in particular. So I've managed to stay in one place for 4 years at a time. That's about it. I have 2 4-years, and that's just about it. So when I talk about transition, at least I have some experience. I'm not sure about authority, but I have experience. And the angles are not quite right, so it's going to look a little goofy as I use my computer for my notes now, but we'll get used to it. Thank you. I think I'm going to roll with it. We'll see how it goes. Lest I forget, thank you so much for having me over here. The folks I met with, transition team, incredible people, and I can yada, yada, yada forever about interim ministry, and they put up with it, even act interested at points. This is impressive. So thank you much for having me. It's a great place. You probably know the story of the sea captain who was respected for his sailing skills despite all kinds of weather. Crew members generally enjoyed serving with him and had over time learned to accept, if not fully understand, the unusual routines he sometimes followed. Foremost was his preparation for setting sail. Before each new junket, he would disappear into his cabin for what the crew could only guess was a moment of prayer and meditation. One dark night, just prior to weighing anchor, a young sailor passed by the captain's quarters. The curtains were left open, and although he felt a bit awkward about peering inside, he just couldn't help himself. It was then that he saw the captain reach into a drawer, remove an envelope, glance at its contents, return it to its hiding place. Taking a deep breath, he looked in the mirror, smoothed his coat, left his quarters for the upper deck. Now, the young sailor tried to resist the temptation to know what was in that envelope, but in the end could not. Treading silently through the hallway upon reaching the captain's cabin, he opened the door, went to the drawer, and grabbed the envelope. As he opened it, a single sheet of paper, a folded sheet of paper, was all that was inside. It was so yellowed. And then, taking a last look to make sure he had not been discovered, he unfolded that sheet of paper, and it read, "Starboard is right, port is left." It's all about the basics, man. In interim ministry, as with life itself, it's all about the basics. So as you make ready for what will be an amazing chapter in your fellowship's half-century-rich narrative, I've come to suggest some spiritual and hopefully practical basics about how to hit the ground running. 4 components that I've come to believe are essential for understanding and then getting the most out of what lies ahead. So, what follows is somewhere between a sermon, a love letter to a sister congregation, and hopefully a cavity-free dental appointment. So, in the interest of time, let's jump. The four things are in order: mission, money, music, and ministry. The alliteration is so clever, you should be impressed. Let's talk mission. Poet, writer, and activist Maya Angelou tells the story of Mrs. Scott, a woman on a mission, but not necessarily the right one. Mrs. Scott, a woman well past middle age, she fancied young men. She was a great churchgoer and used each religious gathering to search for objects of her choice. And all the young men in town were aware of her predilections, and she was unsuccessful in snaring them. But one day, a new man appeared at the meeting house. He was handsome, and although he was an adult, he was young enough to be a little gullible. So the woman caught him directly after service and invited him to come to her home for late Sunday afternoon dinner. He accepted gratefully. She rushed home, killed a chicken, put it on to fry. And while the chicken cooked, Mrs. Scott took a small needle from her sewing kit and, putting on her bifocals, picked her way down the lane from her front door. And when she reached a tree 100 yards away, she stuck that needle in the bark and returned to the kitchen to finish preparing the meal. When the young fella arrived, they sat down to a tasty dinner, for Mrs. Scott was an excellent cook. And after they finished, Mrs. Scott invited the young man to sit on the front porch swing to let his dinner digest. And she brought out lemonade and sat with him. Well, dusk was falling and the shapes of things were beginning to blur. And then Mrs. Scott sat bolt upright and turned to the young man. "What on earth is that I see sticking in that tree?" She pointed down the lane to the oak, which was barely a shadow in the darkness. The young man, squinting, trying to pierce the gloom, said, "Mrs. Scott, I can't hardly see the tree. And you can see something sticking out of it?" "Yes," Mrs. Scott relaxed her scrutiny now. "At first I thought it was a pin, but when I looked for the head, it wasn't there. I saw instead a hole, so it must be a needle." The young man turned to look at Mrs. Scott with admiration. "You know, ma'am, when you left church this morning, some folks told me to be careful, that you were an old woman who loved young men. But I must say, if you can see a hole in a needle 100 yards away after the sun has set, you're not nearly as old as they say you are." Mrs. Scott, proud of her compliments and forgetful of her subterfuge, said, "Well, thank you for that. I'll just go get the needle and show it to you." She flounced up out of the swing and jauntily stepped down the stairs, and when she reached the bottom of the steps, she turned to smile appreciatively at the young man. And then, continuing, she walked 2 steps and tripped over a cow sitting in the lane. Folks, the research is clear. Vital congregations possess clarity of mission. Not just a mission, clarity of mission. Short, evocative, measurable statements that are non-negotiable. A statement of the values to which the congregation will go to the mat. They are historical and hysterical, right at points. They are historical. So those folks who are around for many decades see the changes. They can hold on to the content because the message is still, you can do your own theology. We stand ready to help you do that as you help us. And there's a world out there that's broken. What are we going to do about it? Unchanging across liberal religious history. So, when I talk with a potential interim congregation, I ask two simple but profound questions. For what do you want to be known out there? And how can I help you make it happen for the next period of time? That's what interests me. I like money as much as anybody else. I like job security. But I want to know, for what do you want to be known? So let me pose that to you as you make ready for your interim period. If a congregation has done that work, I tell them, if they have a living mission, not a mission, a living mission, I tell them, let's rock, let's get after it. But if not, I say, how about we get a short and simple process together so you can find out what makes you you, and then we'll rock. But I can't lie to those search committees. I tell them that unless their congregation has many years of practicing mission-led shared ministry, that way of being will be costly. To sell out to a mission means some folks may leave. Some programs may change or disappear. Some practices may be challenged, may morph. Some staff job descriptions may change. And some traditions may be questioned by the 2 generations behind us, boomers. So as you prepare heart and mind for what's coming your way next fall, please don't look at these things as definites. They're simply what I see when I come across congregations who begin to get focused and sell out to the values. So, I cannot overemphasize the importance of clarity, the willingness to take some risks, to think in new ways, to try new stuff. And when a new idea doesn't work, and I got to tell you, I peddle them all the time, think some more, try some new ideas. Think some more, try some new ideas. Change some lives right here in Boise. Money. I'm going to skip the story. It's a great story. It basically boils down to a student who is outside a kitchen and is absorbing the odors. And the owner sees this on a regular, the cook sees on a regular basis and says, "I want you out of here," and he will not leave. So he goes to the judge, and the judge simply says, "I'm going to charge the student the same amount of money." Let me get this straight now. "I'm going to charge the student the same amount of money for the smells." I'll finish the story later. Next time I come see you, I'll have a good story. Good news. I know what it is. It's basically the idea, if I come to a congregation and I have resources that I do not share, that I am indeed enjoying the smells, not so much paying for the meal. That's what I'm trying to say. There are within the Unitarian Universalist Association congregations that have 0 money issues. That's swell. That's the good news. What do you think the bad news is? That ain't you. It is not my place to tell you how to handle the slice of stewardship that has to do with money. But I can tell you from broad experience that there is no such thing as a healthy congregation without healthy financial practices and resources. I've never seen it. So let me encourage you to study what financially flush congregations of your size, what they do to make sure their dreams don't stay in the what if stage and move on to the when do we start. Because the quality of your interim period will rely in part upon how wide and how deep you're giving. Interim ministers are by and large a pretty sharp and talented crew, but we don't print money. So I hope you'll make your next generosity campaign an exercise in community building and a new high in results. Quick confession. I no longer believe that the sermon has to be the centerpiece of a service. Everything I'm told by young adults, everything I see in the literature tells me that I'm not alone on this. Back to vital congregations across the theological specter. There's plenty of research to suggest that music as a form of ministry and tool for change is equally and sometimes more effective. But I didn't come to argue with you on that point. Just to suggest that a good and a diverse music program is as critical to the interim period as to settled ministry. A solid program can be a stabilizing effect during the many changes of interim ministry. It can be a source of healing, a source of respite, joy, and that sacred stillness. So I state the obvious when I say that done well, music breaks down barriers of class and ethnicity and theology. Hold on to your music. Beautiful stuff, by the way. Hold on to your music. Nurture it. Find ways to fund it. Get outside any box that's been hindering you. Give it a shot. If music gives voice to our tears and our fears, it inspires us in terms of justice work. Keep that in mind and leave it at this. Keep the music coming. You know it's not performance. It's a manifestation of a unique and universal ministry. It takes our soul's places, word and silence and ritual simply cannot. Keep after the music. Your interim minister will thank you. Finish up here. Ministry. Following a Sunday service, a minister and her two children were visiting a military cemetery. The younger child asked her mother, "Mom, where did all these dead people come from?" "They died in the service, sweetheart." Came the next question. "Was that the morning or the evening?" Following their Sunday service, the preacher took Ms. Andrews aside. Her husband had taken to falling asleep during the sermon of late, and would she mind waking him up if it happens again? Ms. Andrews had already taken a step in the other direction when she suggested that since the preacher was the one to put him to sleep, the preacher ought to be the one to wake him up. Boise friends, what I do for a living is highly rewarding. I have a blast, but it is rarely easy. I have lots of supports. I call upon them on a regular basis. Because my colleagues and I, we travel the continent, rarely staying in one place beyond 3 years. We enter your congregational systems, we get to know you, and then we compare your practices and your cultures with what we know is working out there in similar-sized congregations. At our best, we love you as we take leadership in your congregations. We remember whose church it is, whose church or fellowship it is. But we are called to give you ministry in this age, not the 1970s. So while the vast majority of us count ourselves lucky to be of use to you, we work too much, we play too little. And although it's changing, some folks peg us as settled ministers or our settled colleagues, or they think we are placeholders until the real minister hits town, neither of which is accurate. This is good work we do, but it comes at a cost. So rather than whine about interim ministry, let's not do that. Let me throw out some random observations about what interim ministry is about. In the course of the last decade or so, interim ministry has morphed from bridging between ministers to revisiting big spiritual questions. Things like, what is the story of our tribe? How well do we treat each other? For real, how well do we treat each other? Are the things we always talk about of ultimate importance? How much room is there for creativity and the new ideas that follow? What kind of stewards are we? And who is our neighbor? Interim phases have a primarily internal... I'm moving along now, different point. Interim ministries have a primarily internal focus. We place greater emphasis on governance and administration to strengthen the institution for the long haul. In response, interim ministers give less attention to pastoral care. We don't socialize much with you. We don't want a bond. We don't want to feel what we feel anyway when we leave. By definition, the change in ordained leadership, new point, by definition, the change in ordained leadership means trying on a different style of ministry in general, different patterns of worship in particular. Transitional phase is the congregation's opportunity to do some window shopping about what it wants in its next settled minister. Next point, leadership development has become central to our work. As congregations do that bold work of answering those kinds of big questions, it's critical that they prepare and support and hold to accountability those who are charged to apply that learning at every level. Last point. The interim period is meant to be a spiritual, not just organizational experiment. The takeaway, as much as I love them, are not just mission-driven, organized congregations. The end is an increase in the love in this world because folks and their interim minister got down to spiritual brass tacks. So in the end, the measure of an interim ministry is not how streamlined its infrastructure, but how well it welcomes the first-time visitor, how well it nurtures its young, and does it put a dent in that indifference out there in the world. Let me finish where I began by drawing your attention to these four basic components of the work before you. Mission, money, music, and ministry. So, there are no doubt better, certainly less homely ways of talking about the work that I do. But either way, I wish for you and Elizabeth a swell, if I know, bittersweet goodbye. Throw a good bash, one that she will remember forever. And I fully expect to hear good reports about you as you build this fine fellowship into an even finer fellowship, an even better place than you have built with Elizabeth over the last 25 years. I say blessings on you all the way. And oh, by the way, when things get screwy, and you know they will, starboard is right, port is left. How many of you have been to Weezer? Well, look at you. Okay, how many of you have been to the fiddle contest? Look at you. Let's talk after the service, okay? I'm this close in Oregon. I want to get over there. I hear there are a few people these days, though. It gets a little popular? Yeah. Okay, we'll work with that. I'm doing this not to be cute, folks. I want to lift up the importance of music. And again, I got the amen nods as I was talking about music. But I think there's something to be said for the kind of gut-level story here. From Fulgham, I'm betting that many in the room have read that. That's me. Many in the room have heard that story. Here we go. The big deal of my summer was a week in Weezer, Idaho. And maybe that's hard to believe because if you've ever looked at an Idaho map, you know that Weezer is pretty much nowhere. But if you can fiddle, Weezer, Idaho is the center of the universe, because the Grand National Old Time Fiddlers Contest is there the last week in June. And since he says I fiddled around a little bit in my time, I decided I'd go. 4,000 people live there in normal times. 5,000 more come out of the bushes and the trees and the hills for the contest. The town stays open around the clock with fiddling in the streets, dancing in the VFW hall, fried chicken at the Elks Lodge, and free camping at the rodeo grounds. People from all over show up. Fiddlers from Pottsboro, Texas, Sepulpa, Oklahoma, Thief River Falls, Minnesota, Caldwell, Kansas, Three Forks, Montana, and just about every crossroads town you can mention, including Japan. It used to be the festival was populated by your country folks, pretty straight types, short hair, church on Sunday, women and their place, and all that. And then the long-haired hippie freaks began to show up. The trouble was the freaks could fiddle, and that's all there is to it. So the town turned over the junior high and its grounds to the freaks. The contest judges were put in an isolation booth where they could see, I could only hear the music, couldn't see the people, and just the fiddling came through. As one old gentleman put it, son, I don't care if you're stark naked and wear a bone through your nose. If you can't fiddle, you're okay with me. It's the music we make that counts, he said. So I was standing there in the middle of the night, in the moonlight in Weezer, Idaho, with about 1,000 other people who were picking and singing and fiddling together, some with bald heads, some with hair to their knees, some with a joint, some with a long neck bottle of Bud, some with beads, some with Archie Bunker t-shirts, some 18, some 80, some with corsets, some with no bras. And the music, rising to the night toward whatever gods of peace, whatever goodwill there be. I was standing there, he says, and this police officer, a real, honest-to-God, Weezer police officer, is standing next to me picking a banjo. I swear it, picking a banjo. And then he says to me, "Sometimes the world seems like a pretty fine place, don't it?" "Oh, yes, and yes again," he finishes. "Yes, it does." Music.